Blog Talk Radio.
So it's faith-based. So you're involved with faithism, not atheism, right?
It was that you said, saying that, you know, a lot of Christians, they maybe text or they maybe email you, and, you know, they was pretty much scared of you. And I said, oh, okay, a challenge, okay.
No, I believe the Bible. I don't believe the Bible is saying that slavery is okay because it gives instructions about how to handle slavery. Andrew, that's faith. You just said you accept evolution theory. So that's faith. You got faith in a theory.
By any chance, are you gay?
What do you think about Oates?
Hello. Thanks so much for joining me here on a very special episode of the Atheist Roundtable. Tonight I'm going to air my second half of my interview with Callie Wright. Again, if you are not listening to the Gaytheist Manifesto, you got to go and start listening to the Gaytheist Manifesto. Callie Wright is one of the most awesome people alive, and she is truly one of the great leaders of the atheist movement and of the LGBT rights movement, and her show shows you why. So we're jumping right back into my interview with Callie Wright.
I want to switch gears here real quick to the other side of your activism in atheism. I don't know if I've ever heard your atheism story.
I don't tell it often, and that's why.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't, were you ever religious?
Well, so here's the thing. The reason why I don't talk about my atheism story is because, frankly, it's not super interesting. I went to church with my grandma when I was a kid, up until the time when I was about 16 or so. And I was a very lukewarm Christian. You know, I think for me, it was just more of a thing that I did with my grandma because I loved my grandma. And I mean, a lot of it seemed to make sense to me as a kid, like just because that was, you know, I was never being taught otherwise. So it's like, you know, oh, you know, there's this being who created you and loves you and, you know, listens to your prayers and, you know, will comfort you when you're hurting and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, yeah, that all sounds great to me. And like I said, I was pretty lukewarm about it. I mean, I was never like an evangelical. I was never one who would like preach at other people or anything like that about it. It was just kind of, like I said, I was a lukewarm Christian. And, there were kind of a couple of things that, you know, started that made me start to question. And, you know, one of them was actually reading the Bible. I mean, that's, you know, the story that everyone tells is, you know, reading the Bible made me an atheist faster than anything. Like, that's kind of a joke and it's almost a cliche at this point, but it's, I mean, how many of us can say that? Because it's true. Like, so, you know, it was a combination of that and getting into high school and being around people who weren't religious. And I remember in particular, there was this guy who was super, super smart, and he was a really nice guy. And I just remember him just tearing Christianity down. And I remember thinking to myself, like, well, I know he's smart, and I know he's a good person, but he's saying all these really horrible things about Christianity. And in my mind, Christianity was still, like, the default thing, right? And anyone who wasn't Christian was, like, this weird, possibly Satanist, like, bad person. But, like, you know, I heard him saying this stuff and realizing that he wasn't a bad person. And, you know, so that made me really start, like, well, I'm going to go ahead and read this Bible thing. I'm going to figure out what all this is about, and I'm going to start researching. And I did, and I realized that none of it actually made sense to me. So I just kind of left it behind. You know, there was never a huge, you know, internal emotional struggle over it for me. I was a little bummed at first because it's like, wow, you know, if there's no God, I guess that means there's no heaven, which I guess means, you know, when I die, that's it. Like, that's kind of depressing. But, like, there was never this huge emotional struggle or, you know, my grandma didn't disown me for being atheist, even though she's a pretty fundamentalist Christian. I mean, you know, we would have debates and they would get kind of annoying sometimes like they do, but it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't a relationship defining thing like me, you know, leaving religion. So, you know, that it was an almost entirely intellectual journey for me. So it wasn't really, it's not something that colored my life so much that so I don't have like this, you know, really like inspiring, you know, story or anything like that about being an atheist. Like once I did the research and learned about stuff, like that just kind of turned to be the most sensible thing for me. And it wasn't until, you know, I started reading, like, you know, the Four Horsemen, those folks, the books that they read and stuff, that, you know, kind of made me realize, like, wow, this is a problem. And, you know, maybe self-identifying as an activist and openly having conversations with people about this kind of stuff is a thing that might be important to do. And so, you know, that kind of started my phase of like, well, I'm just going to debate with religious people and be very open about being an atheist, and never really took it any further than that for a long time. And then, I got into a relationship. We were going to get married. So I was like, you know, focused on adult life and all that kind of stuff. So I stepped out of it a little bit. And I was in a band and we toured, and, you know, my mind was very much on that. And I'd kind of turned into a passionate atheist at that point. I don't know if I would call myself an activist at that point, because I really wasn't. And then I started listening to podcasts, and I started listening to the, everybody says The Atheist Experience is a TV show, but it's a podcast to me, because that's the first way I heard it. all the basic 101 atheist podcasts, like, you know, Atheist Experience and Dogma Debate and, you know, shows like that. And listening to those shows kind of made me want to be an atheist activist. But I was, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood, I'd come out as trans, and I'd started to, you know, really explore my identity, you know, in that way. And at that point, it seemed like a separate thing for me. Like, you know, I'm into atheism, and I want to do atheist activism stuff, and I'm also doing LGBT activism in my own community and getting involved with support organizations and stuff like that here in Cincinnati, where I'm from. And the idea of putting them together and doing them as a combined effort didn't really cross my mind for the first time until I went to a marriage equality rally in downtown Cincinnati. This was last summer, so summer of 2014. And they had a commitment ceremony where they got, I think it was like 10 or 12 different gay couples, and they gathered them together on Fountain Square, which is kind of like the center of downtown Cincinnati. And so they had this commitment ceremony, and it was officiated by an affirming member of the clergy from some church in Cincinnati, wherever they're from. And in the course of performing the ceremony, he actually said the words, "If you don't know God, you don't know love, and if you don't know love, you don't know God." And I thought to myself, like, wow, that's a pretty aggressive thing to say in front of this crowd. Like, there are a lot of people in this community who have been hurt very badly by religion and want nothing to do with it. And so, like, that kind of planted the seed, I guess, a little bit. I didn't really, you know, decide to take action or anything at that point. But that kind of planted the seed, like, man, maybe atheist activism and LGBT activism are a thing that makes sense to go together. But, you know, that was kind of in the back of my head. I was involved with another organization at the time that did support for victims of rape and sex abuse. And that was something that I was and still am very passionate about, but that's not something I have a personal history with. So it's not something that I can speak from personal experience or with as much conviction as someone who has a personal stake in the issue. And then what it ended up doing it for me was kind of like the final straw was when Lila Alcorn died in December. We had two vigils for her because she was actually from Cincinnati, where I'm from. And anybody who's listened to the show has heard me tell this story, but there was another, you know, affirming member of the clergy there who was talking about God and all that. And she actually said the word that I believe God was a first responder on the highway that day. And, you know, as an atheist, that unbelievably repugnant thing to say, because you're implying that God stood by and watched while this girl's family tortured her with conversion therapy and rejected her, isolated her from her friends, watched as she made the decision to commit suicide, as she wrote her suicide note, auto-posted it to Tumblr, walked out on the highway, and watched as the truck hit, and then decided to show up. Like, come on. And that was kind of the final straw for me. Like, you know, like these things have to go together.
I really think they do. I think they go together really well. And especially because of, exactly as you say, the harm that has been inflicted upon this community by religious people. And even when affirming clergy try to say nice things, try to say words of comfort. I mean, these, I don't think for a second that either one of these people was coming from a place of malice or ill intent. All they wanted to do was to give some kind of nice, affirming message. But if you think about it for just a little bit, it turns into something ugly really fast.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And, I mean, it's so, I mean, at the very, very least, it's incredibly tone deaf. We had the Transgender Day of Remembrance this past week, which, for those who don't know, is a day where we memorialize trans people who've lost their lives to violence because of being trans. And at the ceremony that we had here in Cincinnati, there was a pastor who's actually a transgender pastor who is the head of this affirming church here. And they were going on and making comparisons to people like Abraham and to Paul. And I'm thinking to myself, like, look, I am not the world's foremost Bible expert, okay? But, like, don't compare my community to someone who was ready to sacrifice his kid on a rock for God. No, I'm not okay with that. And don't try and pretend like Paul wasn't the one that says homosexuals deserve death in the New Testament.
All right.
Don't bring that shit into my community. You know, and people say this stuff because it sounds good, but they don't think of the context, especially because, sure, there are probably religious people in the room who are going to eat it up because they're not giving it a second thought either. But, you know, I mean, for somebody like me, it makes me mad, but there are people who have actual trauma because of the way that they were received by their religious family or, you know, at their church, who don't want to be, they don't want to have that shit thrown in their face, you know, especially when you put those things in context. Like, don't quote Paul in LGBT struggles. The dude thought we deserved to die for who we are, you know, and he was also the one, if memory serves, the one who said women, shouldn't be allowed to speak in church. like, you know, the guy you're quoting, right? Talking about the LGBT struggle. Get the hell out of my face with that. So, in the thing that I think is important to point out is it's not just about religiously inspired bigotry, and it's not just about the tone-deaf things that religious people say, even sometimes trying to help. The flip side of this is that for people who are atheists, especially if they grow up in super oppressive religious environments, their religion their religion is their identity, right? And leaving that, leaving your religion, leaving your church, sometimes can cause as much of an identity struggle as someone who is struggling with their gender, with their sexuality, because they're literally shifting their entire paradigm of how they view the world and how they view their place in it and how, you know, they're going to be received by their family, by their friends, by their communities and their peers. And, you know, you grow up thinking that, you know, like for me, for example, you grow up thinking like, well, if you're born a man, you're a man and you do man things and you're manly and you have a beard. And like, you know, like that's just what you grow up with. And when you start to realize that that's not who you are, there's an incredible struggle that comes with that because you're fighting cultural programming, and cultural programming is incredibly powerful. And if you grow and I didn't grow up in one of these environments, and that's the reason I didn't put two and two together at first. Even when I first started doing this kind of activism, you know, I mean, it took me after getting into it for a while to recognize that the connection actually went this deep. You know, to hear people talking about their struggles leaving religion, I was like, holy shit, these people are telling the same story. You know, if you take out all of the language about God and religion and replace it with whatever LGBT language there is, like, you're telling the same story. So there's that intersectionality, too, that I think is important to point out. You know, it's not just the fact that religion generally takes a dim view of queer and trans people, which, I mean, it definitely does, and that's obviously a conversation worth having, and that's a fight worth fighting. But there's that other side of it, too, that's just, you know, I think, you know, we as queer and trans folks and as atheists, I think we are more uniquely primed to have empathy for one another because some of our struggles are similar, even if they're about different things. So it's important, I think, to put that part of it together as well.
I couldn't agree more. So I got my last question here, and I think this is the most important one of the whole podcast because I know that you're a Star Trek geek.
I hope we're about to fight. I so hope we're about to fight.
So, would you get into a transporter?
Well, Okay. So maybe we're not about to fight because I don't know. And you ask me this question because you know how much of a nerd I am,
uh-huh.
And you know beyond any shadow of a doubt that this is a thing I've thought about a lot.
Exactly.
Especially that episode with Lieutenant Barclay, because he's petrified of getting in a transporter. I don't know. Let me say a few things definitively. I would not volunteer to test the prototype. I will say that definitively.
Yeah. Well, there was that episode with the transporter accident that made a copy of Riker as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which, God, how creepy is that? Like, I don't want there to be a second me out there.
I know.
It'd be weird.
So, stepping into a transporter has always been my most interesting Star Trek question, although you were probably thinking I was going to ask you Kirk or Picard, but the answer to that question is obviously Picard.
Sisko, yeah.
Oh, really? Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow, I don't think I've ever heard anyone go with Sisko before.
Yeah, well, like, I thought you were going to ask me who my favorite captain was, because that's what you normally, you know, and that's, you know, normally the question that ends. So much so that when I mention being a Star Trek fan in my talks, I usually just get it out of the way. Like, yeah, my favorite captain is Sisko. Debate me, I'll win, because I will win.
I have to rewatch DS9 again. I got stuck in Voyager, and I remembered why I couldn't finish watching it the first time around.
Okay. So I'm going to talk for a second about the transporter thing, and then I'm going to make my case for Sisko, okay?
Okay, go.
So like I said, I would definitely not volunteer to test the prototype. You know, I would need to know – and let me ask this. Are we talking about a transporter that theoretically works the same way the one in Star Trek does?
Yes. Theoretically, it works exactly
okay.
the same way.
Right, because – obviously, the question is, you know, is the thing that comes out on the other side of the transporter actually you?
There you go.
And that's, you know, I mean, that's kind of the ship of Theseus, you know, dilemma, the philosophical dilemma.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I would have to know a little bit more about the process and the physics of how it works, because obviously Star Trek leaves a little bit of that to the imagination, because obviously the technology doesn't exist. You know, after a repeated demonstration of its safety and efficacy, you know, maybe, I don't know. But definitively would not volunteer to be like the first one through or anything. Okay. So, and as far as the captain thing goes, okay. So let me preface this by saying that my reasons for thinking Sisko is the best captain, they may be a little unfair to the other captains because we got to see him in a lot of circumstances we didn't get to see other captains in. So, the first and most important argument is that Sisko is half god.
Okay.
So he really is the prophets, the wormhole aliens.
Oh, right.
His mother.
His mother was a wormhole alien, or one of the prophets, or the Bajoran gods. So I mean, he's literally half god. So there's that side of things. But on a more serious note, you never really get to see any other captain's morality be tested in a repeated way under the kind of pressure that you got to see Sisko's morality tested during the Dominion War. There was really not ever a point where any captain other than Sisko had actually the entire weight of the Alpha Quadrant. Like, I'm going to make this decision and it's going to mean, you know, the Federation literally falls or, you know, the Federation wins. Sisko had to make those kinds of decisions several times, and no other captain really did that much. We got to see him. We got to see him in wartime. We got to see him as a negotiator. We got to see him as a scientist. We got to see him as a father, and as a good father, a single father, and a Starfleet captain.
Yeah, that was the best part of Sisko, I thought, was that he's the only captain that we got to see a real family life behind.
Exactly. And, you know, the fact that he was able to juggle all of those things and be good at them most of the time is a huge argument in his favor. And, you know, you get to see his humanity, I think, because, you know, Kirk was obviously, you know, the ladies' man, the cowboy. And I love Captain Picard. And Captain Picard was a role model for me because I grew up without a dad. And Captain Picard was like my like role model father figure. So I'm definitely not knocking him at all. But, you know, throughout basically all of Next Gen, I mean, he is this paragon of virtue. And it gets tested sometimes, but it never got tested to the level that Sisko's got tested during the Dominion War, to where he's like involved in assassination plots and shit, you know, because he knows if he doesn't do it, the Federation is going to lose the war. And, you know, the entire Alpha Quadrant becomes occupied by the Dominion, you know, because he's not willing to bend or break the rules a little bit. And the fact that he was able to do that, and, you know, you see this episode where he's actually he ends up involved in an assassination plot, you know, kind of sort of unwittingly, but, you know, at the very end of the episode, you know, he says that he can live with it because at the end of the day, like, you know, the Federation wins, and all it really cost was, you know, the lives of two people who weren't that great of people anyways, and his own self-respect. And, like, is that too high of a price to pay for the entire Alpha Quadrant? Like, I don't think DS9 gets enough credit for exploring morality in the way that it does, especially during the Dominion War. I think the Dominion War is some of the best television ever written. And we never got to see any of the other captains under that much pressure in situations like that. So that's my case for Sisko as my favorite captain. You may not agree, but I think you have to at least admit that I make a solid case.
I absolutely agree that is an extremely solid case, and that we're going to have to get DS9 back in my queue on Netflix. Callie, I want to say that the Gaytheist Manifesto is the podcast that I look forward to every week. It's not just activism. It's heartwarming, gut-wrenching activism. You, with your podcast, reach into and grab a hold of your audience and bring them along with you on a journey that we can't help but fall in love with you. It is fantastic to be able to join you in that journey on a weekly basis, and to feel be a part of be a part of that. That's just amazing. I love it. And I want to thank you so much for the things that you do on the Gay Theist Manifesto.
That is, God, like, you're about to make me cry, Andrew.
Your last episode on the Day of Remembrance, the Transgender Day of Remembrance, I couldn't listen to it at work. I couldn't do it.
I actually got several Facebook messages to that effect.
I thought I was going to listen to it at work, and I was wrong.
And, you know, I don't... I'm not going to pretend like I don't go out of my way to try and tug heartstrings and try and, you know, move people's emotions. I mean, that's definitely one of my goals is to humanize, I tried to say humanize and personalize both together, and it didn't work out super well for me. But, you know, to very much personalize the things that LGBT people in general, and especially trans people go through, because you know there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the atheist community as a whole wants to do good by our community. You know, I mean, you see at least one atheist group at every Pride Festival, you know, if not more. And you know, I get so many questions from so many different people about things that they can do to make their spaces more safe and welcoming to LGBT people. And so like, there are so many people in this movement that are so passionate about, you know, doing right by the LGBT community. And I think, I mean, I think it's amazing, you know, but I think more than me just, you know, standing on a platform telling people what to do to be better, if I can just tell my story and give other folks platforms to tell their stories, you know, instead of saying, well, you know, here's, you know, top five things you can do to be a better ally, you know, I can tell you a story about someone, you know, something that somebody did that hurt me and why it hurt me, or something that somebody did that was amazing and why it's amazing and why it might not be a totally intuitive thing for someone who doesn't necessarily think about these things all the time. And so, you know, part of my goal with the show, and you know, I mean, if your praise is any indication, I guess I'm doing an okay job at it, is to not so much be preachy about, you know, here's all the things that you can do to be better. I mean, although I most definitely do that sometimes, and I mean, I own the fact that I do that, but it's also just to, you know, you look at the polling surrounding the gigantic paradigm shift in this country when it comes to you know, the idea of marriage equality. And if you look at when, you know, if people change their mind, why they change their mind, the overwhelming answer is that, well, you know, I found out that someone I loved was gay, or I got to know someone who was gay. And you figure out that, like, you know, well, aside from this one thing, they're not really that different from me. You know, I mean, I have, you know, I mean, I just had a hugely intellectual conversation about a fictional, you know, science fiction universe. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a nerd. I love Star Trek. I love music. I love movies. You know, I have a girlfriend that I love, and I have, you know, I love dogs, and I have friends, and, like, I mean, I'm just a human being, and there are definitely unique challenges that I face because of who I am. But, you know, aside from that, I'm not really that different than anyone else. And I think if I can just let people in to that, the, you know, the good stuff and the bad stuff, you know, I don't obviously don't shy away from the bad stuff on my show. It gets pretty heavy sometimes, and I'm okay with that. I think that does more for the cause of allyship than any, you know, dry presentation on, like, you know, 10 things you can do to be a better ally. And so that's, you know, I think it's important, like, because, I mean, I have such a great support structure. Like, I am relatively comfortable being very vulnerable and very open with the things that I struggle with, you know. I mean, I still get feedback on episode 4 of my show, and episode 40 was the last one. And it's an episode where we talked about transgender bathroom bills, where all these politicians are basically trying – when it comes down to it, they're trying to stop trans people from using public restrooms. And in the middle of that episode, I kind of break down and start sobbing. And because I, you know, kind of came to this realization that, like, you know, the right has kind of given up the fight when it comes to marriage equality and even somewhat when it comes to gay equality in general. And, you know, their next target is the trans community. And there are people in our community who are very vulnerable. And I don't know what the body count is going to be like because of that. You know, and I think about people that I know in my community, especially kids who are super vulnerable. And it terrifies me to think that, you know, they're going to be affected by that backlash and I'm going to lose somebody in my community to suicide because of something like that. Like, it pains me. And it's a very real possibility. I mean, we had a suicide in our community earlier this year. It wasn't someone that I knew. I mean, it was somebody that I had met before, but it wasn't somebody that I really knew or was close to. So, you know, I have the privilege of being able to be open about my vulnerabilities and the things that I struggle with. And I don't do it because I want everyone to know every intimate detail of my life, but I think it's important. I think it's important to humanize those things. You know, these things don't just happen to this other group of people that's over there somewhere. That's like this mysterious, you know, cult-like group of people that you only hear about on, you know, tabloid news stories or whatever, you know, because you and I can have a, you know, an intellectual discussion about science fiction. So you know that I'm just a person, you know, and then I can turn around and I can talk about things like trans bathroom bills and why that stuff is super harmful and, you know, how much it sucks that, I mean, I get anxiety every time I walk into a public restroom, every single time. It's gotten better over time, but I still have anxiety over it, even at work, you know, as awesome as my employer is, I still, you know, fear that there's going to be that one person, because I know people who have been physically assaulted, violently physically assaulted, for being quote unquote in the wrong bathroom. And I think it's important for those stories to be told. And I think it's important for people to understand those things in more than I don't want to just tell you that those things happen. I actually want those stories to be heard. So, you know, that's why I do what I do on the show. And it makes me feel really, really good to know that there's some success with that, because it can be uncomfortable sometimes for me to, you know, I do an audio journal for the patrons of my show. And one of the audio journals, I talk about my first time experiencing anything sexual after, you know, starting hormones. And it's not because I want everyone to know the intimate details of my sex life, but I think it's important for people to understand, again, like, I'm a person. Most people enjoy sex and sexuality. I'm no different from that. And it's okay for me to want that and for me to own that too. And it's not weird. It's not wrong. It's not odd. It's just, I'm just a person who enjoys sex and sexuality. So I'm going to talk about it because I want to demystify it. And I don't want it to be this weird, like, taboo thing. So, you know, that's why I think it's important to have those conversations. And so, you know, I'm really glad to hear that, you know, that it has that effect on people, because that's exactly what I'm going for.
So let everybody know exactly how they can support you, how they can support your show, and how they can and all of that stuff that you need to do to make sure that people who want to find you can do that.
Okay, so I am at Gaytheist Cali on Twitter, although I will admit that I kind of suck at Twitter and I don't tweet that much. The show is at the Gaytheists. I'm on Facebook, just Cali Wright, CalliWright. I'll add basically anyone. You can find the show on iTunes, any of the, you know, Android podcast apps. It's on Spreaker. You can just search for the Gaytheist Manifesto on Spreaker. It'll pop up there. The feed is at gaytheistmanifesto.secularmediagroup.com. Let's see. I think that's basically it.
Don't forget to tell people how they can support you on Patreon, Callie.
Right, patreon.com/thegaytheistmanifesto. I don't have a ton to offer patrons. Patrons get to hear episodes 2 days early. I put my show up Thursday mornings, and patrons generally get to hear it at the very least by like late Tuesday night. I'll shout you out on the show, and at a certain level, we do a monthly Gaytheist Hangout where you just do a Google Hangout and get together and talk and just hang out and have fun. So.
Oh, and before you go, at the end of each episode, you end it with a fantastic message of outreach and hope and friendship. Would you do me the honor of ending my episode with that?
I absolutely would. That's an awesome, awesome ask. So before we go, I want you to know that if you're lost, if you're hurting, if you're scared, if you feel like no one cares and no one understands, you need to know there is a community out here that loves you, cares for you, knows that you're capable of amazing things and that you are worthy of love. If you're struggling, please don't be afraid to reach out. Until next time, friends, this is the Atheist Roundtable.
Callie Wright, you are amazing. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Like the fan page for the Atheist Roundtable at /AtheistRoundtable on Facebook, or find your host at /AndrewTheAtheist. Send all of your email to AndrewTheAtheist@gmail.com. This podcast is the official podcast of atheists, humanists, and agnostics of the Wabash Valley. Find us on Facebook for monthly meetups. Music for this episode is provided, as always, by Dick Richards. Thank you, Dick. God isn't here. We are.